Hey everyone, on this week's episode, I'm joined by Philadelphia Phantoms and RPI Hall of Famer Neil Little. An 11th round selection by the Flyers in the 91 entry draft, he spent his entire 10-year career in North America with the organization before heading overseas to finish out. He won two Calder Cups with the Phantoms, and despite dressing 40 or 50 NHL games, only had one start and two appearances. But he's a folk hero in Philadelphia, not just for his incredibly consistent goaltending, but also his willingness to mix it up with opponents. One of the true beauties of the game. Enjoy!
I got an invite to try out there, went out there, and didn't make the team. Maybe first cut. I thought I was pretty good first cut. I think they brought in a couple Europeans, and I was out the door. But I'd like to go back and see who actually made that team. But regardless, I went and played in Estevan, Saskatchewan, just by chance. I made a phone call to the head coach there. His name was Kevin Janel of the Janel Hockey Lore, and he said, "Why don't you come? I still got a spot. There's a couple guys looking for the same job. Why don't you come in and see how you can do?" I ended up making the team and having a really good job. I was rookie of the year in the league and blah, blah, blah. And I had a bunch of scholarship offers, but I ended up going to RPI. Now I got a young kid. Young Nick was born December 1st. I got caught in a snowstorm in Yorkton, Saskatchewan, and I got the news on a payphone after the game. So, you know, like this, it was that era where there was no cell phones. It was, you know, had some options. And I really liked the cell job that Buddy Powers and the Rensselaer staff did at the time. So I went down some visits and whatnot, but ended up choosing RPI. And that's how I got to RPI. Wanted to be a WHLer. While I was in Estevan, I was still being heavily recruited in the dub because I was having an excellent year. And at the time, Swift and Graeme James was the coach of Swift, offered me this contract that I don't think existed at the time. They were going to pay for my college. They were going to give me double veteran money. But I went and met with them, and I was so freaked out that I said, No, I'm not going to go there.
Yeah, I think you made a pretty good decision with that. I mean, that's it's really good intuition. Wow.
I was like, it didn't feel right. I walked into this office with no lights on, just one light, and it was like meeting the dawn, you know? I mean, it was like the guy almost elusive and like roundabout. It felt like I was in the wrong place. So I'm like, no, you know what? I appreciate the offer, but I'm going to go to college. That's just a little side tidbit. Anyways, went to RPI, had a great coach, and that's where it kind of started. I got drafted after my freshman year, and that's kind of how it started rolling.
So did you go to RPI?
That's a long answer to a short question.
Yeah, that's fine. That's why we have an hour to do with this. Did you show up at RPI as a true freshman, or were you 19 when you came in?
I was 19, yeah. So, true freshman, I'm not sure, but, 18 is true freshman, but I might as well have been. I was a...
Well, you were a man at that point. You had a kid, you had a child, you were in college. when you got to RPI?
Well, I'm not sure I was a man. I was 156 pounds.
Wow. At 6'1", yeah. You were 156 pounds.
I was 6'1", and 156 pounds as a freshman. And then, I played it around, my last few years around 190, and now I'm a little heavier than that, but... Yeah, a big difference from, I was a late developer and, I was coordinated, but I was like, pencil thin. So, as far as life experiences, I was above the curve. As far as physical, no, I was way behind. So,
yeah, in the early 90s, though, what was the ECAC like? You think about how college hockey's really grown and expanded and improved in recent times. In the early 90s, did you find that it was still a really high level of hockey that prepared you for pro?
Well, I mean, my first year I played with Joey Juneau. He was a senior captain. So that was about as good as it got. He was exceptional. So I always, if I was going to rank where the top level players were, I could see it every day in Joey because, he was best collegiate athlete at the time, and you know, up for the Hobie, and he should have won it, but I'm not sure. Maybe he did win it. I can't remember now, but went on to a successful career as a skilled guy. But there were some guys at that level, and it was just getting to that level. That was the Paul Kariya level. That was the you know, era. Like, so college hockey was just starting to get the ball rolling and really starting to put some quality guys into the next level. So I always thought that I was pretty good. My freshman year was just average, but I got the confidence of my head coach Buddy Powers. He put me in a lot of games, and then after my freshman year, I rolled. So I just got better. I felt by the time I was a senior, did I feel like I was NHL ready? I thought so in my mind, but I had no idea. I had grand illusions of stepping right into the National Hockey League and, you know, playing right away, you know, because from what I was hearing, Russ Farwell was at the time, Russ Farwell was the GM of Philadelphia. He had drafted me after my freshman year. So when I was a senior, Russ was still in charge, gave me a big ticket. And from what I was understanding, I was going to just jump right in and get some games right away, get my feet wet. So as soon as I signed my contract, Russ Farwell gets fired. Bobby Clark comes in. It was this summer. Like, okay, well, I didn't really hear anything. What's going on? Clark, he didn't even bring me to camp. I didn't even go to camp. So I signed a big ticket. At that time, it was pretty big money for, you know, early 90s. And they didn't bring me to camp. So I'm like, well, what does that mean? I went right to Hershey. Completely missed out on the NHL camp. I'm like, wow, that's kind of strange. I was like 2 weeks in Hershey and down in Johnstown, Pennsylvania before I could blink an eye.
Jeez.
So I'm like, so from coming out of college where I, you know, I had a good college career, so, you know, All American and Hold the Daker and all that stuff. So from going from a real high to like, where am I right now? So I'm in a hotel room that's like 10 by 10. You can't open the bathroom door without hitting the bed. There's a TV in the room, but it's mounted in the top corner of the, you know what I mean? Like, it's mounted in the corner up on the ceiling. It was like a little tiny closet. I'm like, where am I? What am I doing? So it was a rude adjustment into pro hockey, but, yeah, you know, that first year was really tough, and that was an eye-opener. I was not ready. I wasn't ready for that, and I wasn't physically or mentally ready to take on any adversity. So, you know, it was a process for sure.
Was that first year in Johnstown, anything from the ECHL really stick out in your mind aside from that hotel room, the road trips, the per diem, all those type of things? Also, though, how did you end up in Hershey and end up playing almost 20 games for them? Because you didn't spend the whole year in Johnstown.
No, I split my first year Johnstown to Hershey. So my goalie partner, Aaron Israel, came out of Harvard at the same time. We both signed contracts out of college. So when we came in the same time as Clarkie came in. Clarkie didn't know who we were. We didn't come to camp. So we were right to the coast. And we would take 2 week shifts, like 2 weeks or 3 weeks in, 3 weeks out from Johnstown to Hershey, and then back again. So we'd kind of do the flop and switch. And I think after Christmas, I might have spent more time up in Hershey than I did in Johnstown. But at the same time, I wasn't like a regular American League player at that time. But some of the things that stuck out were that Aaron Israel and I had our own house. So they rented us a house. And some of the times we were there together, sometimes not. But I just remember there was nothing to do. So as kids, you know, with nothing to do, not good. So, you know, we go to practice, go to the beer store, go home, or go for lunch, have a couple beers, and then sit on the couch all day and play whatever video game was, you know, at that time, early 90s, whatever it was. And just, you know, pretty much drink beers all day and then have a game every other night or, you know, like just like a very like almost a college attitude toward pro hockey, and not hearing anything of what we should be doing, what we're no coaching, no. So it was crazy. So I remember that, and I remember like just the other random things, like our tough guy on the team was a goalie the year before, like just some random stuff. Like,
hold on, your fighter was a goalie, and he just switched midway through his career.
Oh yeah, he was a goalie turned fighter, tough as nails. Anyway, so just little tiny things like that. I mean, we tried to make the best of it, but I remember calling my old man. I remember calling my dad. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm coming home. Like, this isn't what I signed up for. And he talked me out of it, and he talked me out of it right through my first year pro. I'm like, Dad, I don't want to go back. Like. I'll give the money back. I don't care. But that was not what I was expecting. He's like, okay, well, just, you know what? Get back there. You know, work hard in the summer. Go back. Do your best. And at Christmas time, if you still feel the same way, we'll have this conversation again. So I went back. You know, I trained. So I had a good train. My second year pro, made Hershey as a full-timer. Still had some adjustment problems, and then was still like, Dad, I want to come home. Like a month in, I'm like, this is awful. This is the worst experience of my life. And then our coach got fired in Hershey, and Billy Barber came in. It must have been a couple months into my second year pro, and changed the whole attitude of the entire organization and everybody that I knew. Changed it all. And started, believed in me, played me, gave me all kinds of support, and totally changed my entire attitude. And, he's the only reason, really, that I stuck around and actually had some success. So, it's amazing what one person's attitude and belief can do for you. So, that's Bill Barber.
So is it mostly just the culture that had kind of had you down in the dumps? And I'm also, as I'm listening to this, though, I'm wondering why the hell you ended up in the ECHL after that good of a college career, if it was just a prejudice against college players, or maybe it was just the fact that Bobby Clark wasn't familiar with you, because it felt like they kind of cast you off before you even had a chance to really get going. It's kind of fascinating to see this route that you had.
Well, that's probably it. You probably hit it on the head. In a couple different areas there. One, Bobby Clark didn't know who I was. And second of all, he probably had a collegiate, there was not a lot of college guys coming out at that time. It's just kind of like the NCAA was just starting to produce the players at that time. So I thought that's an old school philosophy where college kids were soft. They were, it was a different mentality. Now, 30-40% of the NHL is collegiate athletes. So, at that time, though, they were just starting to give NCAA collegiate athletes a chance at pro hockey. So there was the stereotype that, not sure about this. Let's wait and see. Again, you need somebody in your corner. So Bobby didn't know who we were, and obviously nobody was stepping up. So it took an extra full year before, get the ball rolling. I remember writing Bobby Clark a letter when I was a kid. I'm like, hey, listen, I don't know what's going on. But because I got sent home my first year pro, like I was up. So I was up at the end of the year, and Hershey was just entering the playoffs, and I was like a third guy / fourth guy with Izzy, Aaron Israel. And they only needed one guy, and we were just starting the playoffs. I can't remember who was playing. Scotty LeGrand, I think, was there at the time, and maybe Freddie Shabbat, I think. Now, Freddie was a fantastic goalie at the American League level. He came in. So Izzy and I were going to be – one of us is going to be the third guy for the playoffs. And I got called into the office by the coach at the time, Jay Leach, and he said, listen – once you get your stuff and get on down the road. Excuse me? Yeah.
That was it. They just said, hey, like, we'll see you next year. Come on to camp in shape. That's it.
Yeah, because he's like, I just tell you, get your stuff and get on down the road. So now you know, my team is in the playoffs and I got to drive home and tell my old man what, like, I don't know why I'm home right now. But
so
I'm like, Dad, don't make me go back. This is the worst experience of my life. I don't understand what's going on. But anyway, it all turned out for the better after year one. So year one was good.
And once Hershey,
a little bit trying.
Once you got out of your time in Hershey, you ended up with the Phantoms in their first year that they came into existence in Philadelphia. You know, little do you know you're going to be a Phantoms Hall of Famer down the road at that point. Was it pretty cool to come in and play in the Spectrum like that in front of a lot of fans and such a heated rivalry? And ironically enough, the heated rivalry was against Hershey, who had been where you were previously. What were those first couple of years with the Phantoms like?
Oh, it was awesome. That was all Billy Barber too. So Ed Snyder and the brass had the idea of moving the American League team to Philly, and we're going to play out at the Spectrum because Ed had just built the new complex right next door, and it was going to be all the same. It was going to be perfect, and it did turn out perfect. And but Billy liked me so much that he kind of made me the poster child for our year one. So I was on, you know, a lot of advertising and stuff like that, and like, you know, he really stuck his neck out and believed in me. So I got all kinds of opportunity, and we had a great team. They put a good roster together. We probably should have won that first year, but I think I'm not sure how to say it. Maybe we had too much skill that wasn't ready to dig in at crucial times. But we were selling out. We were averaging, I don't even know. I think the Spectrum held 18,000. We sold out, I don't know, 10, 15 times. We were probably averaging 12,000. The place was nuts. And so much fun, and played with such a lot of amazing characters, good players and characters. And then second year we won it all. We actually won in the Spectrum. So, you know, 19,000 crazy Spectrum fans. So it was so much fun. It just seemed to work. It was blue collar, cheap tickets, hard working. And I think our team really encapsulated our fan base, and that's how it worked. So,
well, you can tell. I mean, blue collar. I'm looking at this thing, and I think you had 7 or 8 guys that were over 100 penalty minutes, led by Frank the Animal Bielawas, who I probably just butchered his name. But was that a central part of this team you were playing on? Was the toughness, or was that just how the league was back then?
It was a really tough league, no question. It was a man's league. And if you were soft, you weren't going to last. So it was a very tough league, and we had the toughest team. And we had the most skilled team, I thought. So our balance, really, we were tough to play against. And Frankie Bielawas was, you know, the catalyst of that.
I mean, this guy's a folk hero. There's still pictures of him around in Allentown.
Oh, yeah. He's fantastic. I love Frankie. I still love him. He's still local, and he's an amazing individual, and he's unique as unique can be. But they had it right. Like, we had such a tough team, and Frankie and Billy would start Frankie every game. So he'd be on the first shift. The place would be packed. You know, oh, we were so tough. But Frankie, he'd start Frankie every game. And Frankie had a routine before every game where, you know, everybody'd be kind of lined up and ready to go, but Frankie'd still be, he'd always be the last guy to face off. So he'd be over at the bench. Everybody's kind of milling about waiting for Frankie to get to the face off circle. And the place is going crazy. Well, Frankie, number one, had no tape on his stick. Didn't have any tape on his stick.
None on the blade?
He had a little on the knob and nothing on the blade. Like, just a little, maybe like a couple swipes on the top and nothing on the blade. No tape. And he had this, and he'd lean his stick up against the boards, and Derek Settlemyer, the trainer, would have him set up. He had the two water bottles, so the two water bottles would be on the dasher board, spread like 6 inches apart. And in between those water bottles, there was two sniffers. You know, the sniffers, the
boxer sniffers.
Yeah, the ammonia,
right.
Yeah, the ammonia, yeah. So Frankie would come over there, and he put his gloves on the far side of the water bottles, and the stick was leaning up, and he'd take these sniffers, and he had long hair, like down in the middle of his back. So he crack these sniffers and just like inhale both sniffers at the same time with like bent over, so his hair was like kind of over the top, and he could see his head shaking as he's sucking in these two sniffers, and he'd throw the sniffers into the bench while still bent over, take the water bottle, squirt both water bottles over his head at the same time, and then go up and jump up so his hair and the water would fly up, so the water was like spraying like 30 feet in the air. And he was yelling because of the ammonia. So he'd be like,
and he looks like the Undertaker.
And the water would shoot out it would just shoot like for 30 feet, like, you know, in a big arc. And his eyes would be like rolling back in his head, and he's screaming. And he put his gloves on, and he'd grab his stick, and he'd look at the other bench. I remember backing up, so I'd watch this routine on the regular. And he'd just look over at the bench and goes, "I'm gonna fucking kill you."
At the other team's bench?
Yeah, everybody's just scared shitless, and then you go right up to the jaw, and he had no tape on his stick, and it was just a scene that you would never believe. And, you know, first shift would be fantastic. The place is going crazy, and he, you know, but 90% of the time he'd dump the puck in, the D would go back for it, and he'd come charging in on a full head of steam, and the D man would just like get out of the way because, you know. And he'd jump up and he'd hit the old Spectrum glass, and the glass was the old glass that used to go back and forth and made a big sound. So he'd jump up and miss the hit, but hit the glass, and the glass would just go boom, make this big, and the whole 18,000 people would be like, it was priceless. And then obviously he fought a couple times during the game, and you know, he was tough as nails. But we had so many tough guys, but Frankie was, you know, obviously, he sold some tickets for sure. Yeah.
Oh man, I've always wanted to ask somebody though who played on teams that were from that era and that were that tough, especially ask a goalie. Did it make you nervous going into games sometimes just because of the fear of the unknown? It could get completely out of hand at some point. Did it make you nervous?
Oh, we set all kinds of penalty records. We had line brawls upon line brawls upon line brawls, setting all kinds of records. But we were so tough that fear didn't even cross my mind. Like, all I had to do was fight a goalie. So, you know, what are the chances you're going to get beat up? So I used to ask these guys. I played with so many tough guys. I'm like, okay, give me – Frankie's giving tips all the time. I'm like, okay, this – just give me – you know, I got to fight. Like, he's like, okay. And he just showed me a couple things. He's like, you don't have to worry about anything. I'll be there. I'm like, no, but just in case, you know. You should just tie up, just figure out what hand they're throwing with, tie it up and chuck with the other one, keep your eyes open. So, you know, it's pretty basic information, but it got me through a lot of fights against guys that didn't know what they were doing. So,
wow. How many did you think you had in your pro career?
I don't remember. Maybe 8 to 10, I guess. I don't know. Well, I remember they were always entertaining. Like, I had no fear, so I always put on a show. Like, I don't know why I did that. I think the reason I did it is I saw my good buddy Chris Osgood was playing in Adirondack. So right up the road from RPI. So I was about 45 minutes away from my best buddy that we grew up together playing in Medicine Hat. He was playing for Detroit Red Wings farm team, which is in Adirondack. And I was playing at RPI. So I just drive up there and watch his games and hang out. So it was fantastic. But the reason I put some show in my fights is because watching Adirondack, they had a pretty good team at that time. And Darren McCarty of the Grind Line used to put on a show before his fights in the American League, like spin his helmet and throw his gloves. I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. So I love Mac. I think that's where I got it from. Like, just make sure you're entertaining. Like, I don't want to get beat up, but make sure it's entertaining. So I used to spin my helmet and do all kinds of crazy stuff. But knowing that I just had to fight a goalie. So, you know, you could kind of ham it up a little bit, but, you know, it's still serious. But at the same time, it gives the people what their money's worth anyway. So,
is that what led to the flying squirrel moment when you did the famous leap into the brawl against Binghamton, I think it was, 2004 maybe? I mean, this is legendary stuff.
Yeah, the flying
goalie.
You
went completely airborne, nearly nearly sideswiped a guy's head off with your skate by the time you came down. What were you? So many people see this, and the question's always the same. What were you thinking? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, that's got a lot of airtime. The flying goalie got a lot of airtime. You know, if I played in today's era, I think I would have a lot more YouTube hits. There's a lot of good footage that went unnoticed. But anyway, on that one, we were playing against Binghamton at the time, and Ray Emery was playing for Binghamton. And Ray was a tough cat. We had a pretty good rivalry with them, both pretty tough teams at the time. But anyways, Ray was fucking around that night, and he was there was a scrum around his net, and he pitchforked one of our guys so hard. You know, one of our skilled guys, and I laugh about it now, but he went down like a bag of dirt. And so I think that was the final straw, because he was like Ray was on edge that night. Like, he was like very, he was pushing it. But that was the final straw. So after Ray speared one of our guys, now the line brawl kind of started, and I was already on the way, because that was the last straw. On my way down, now the pile's getting bigger. Now it's one big pile, and Ray's in there somewhere. And I don't know why, but I figured, let's just get right in the middle of it. And I just dove, but I didn't know I had that much spring in my step. And I went up, and I went over, and I missed the entire pile. And I landed on the other side, kind of rolled over. Thank goodness nobody got cut with that. I was up high at the time. I just remember like just seeing everything going below me. I'm like, too much of a push. And I went over this, but I kind of come back on the other side, and now I'm getting up, and I'm looking for Ray, and I don't see Ray anywhere, but this one little skilled guy's got me, and now he's got me in the corner, and he's trying to talk to me. He's like, hey, Liz, hang on, how you doing? Hey, I don't know if you remember me, but I went to RPI. I think he was an RPI guy or something like that. Hey, I don't know what's going on. I don't want to fight, but he's talking like a mile a minute.
He was really nervous, obviously.
Like, he didn't know what to do. And I was like, at the time, I didn't really hear him. I was just looking for Ray and see if I could get back in the pile. But he was kind of like pushing me over to the corner. And finally, I looked at him, and he was still talking. I'm like, it's probably a better idea if I stay here with you. Because Ray was so tough. So I face washed him a little bit, and we kind of danced around the corner, and Ray was taking on some of our bigger guns at the time. But I remember that. It was crazy. I remember John Paddock was the coach, and by the time they got me back to the bench, I got a hold of a player's stick, and Paddock was yelling at me from the bench over top of the players, and I took the stick and I pretended to javelin him the javelin throw. So I wound up, and I just, you know, and I stopped it at the last second. Obviously, I didn't show the stick, but I could see Johnny, like, covering up. And like. Now, it's only funny because I coached with Johnny for, like, 3 years after that, and we became great friends after that, and golf partners and stuff like that. But I remember that, like, it was yesterday, him ducking like I was going to throw this stick like a javelin. Best part of the story is, like, 2 days later, we had to play him in Binghamton after this huge, I think we set all kinds of penalty record minutes that night. And then two nights later, now we're back in Binghamton, and I'm playing, and Ray's playing. You know, this is going to be a big one. It's going to be rough. It's going to be line brawls. It's going to get crazy. So I'm skating around warm up. I'm like, I got to get ready for this game, because I know, like, I'm going to have to fight Ray Emery. Like, that's no small task. He's probably Ray's the toughest guy I ever played goal, I would assume. Like,
yeah, so, him or Dan Kluche, Ron Hextall. Take one of those three. I mean, when Kluche's wires would cross, you'd always have to watch out for him, too. He always made me really nervous.
Yeah, Kluche for sure. It's amazing you get to know these guys afterwards. I met Klutz now too, and he's soft-spoken and stuff like that. Worked with Hexy forever, and obviously, and Ray came to Philly, and I picked him up the first day he was in town when we went golfing. So, but God bless him, God rest his soul. But so now we're in Binghamton. We got to play Ray, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna have to fight Ray Emery. This is not gonna. Just, you know, like, I'm just thinking in my head, like, just, all right, it's going to happen, no big deal. So I'm skating around in warm-ups, and you know how you skate around the outside and come through the middle? I'm just getting fed with pucks, like, just pucks off the ass, off the calves, off, like, the shoulder. They're literally firing pucks and zipping them at me as I'm coming through the middle. I turn over, and there's Ray and Brian McGratton.
Oh.
And I don't know who else, some other tough guy, just firing pucks at me. So I come back around again, and they're all standing there, and they're like, you're fucking dead, little. You're fucking dead.
That team was crazy tough. I mean, they had McGratton, and I mean.
Oh, my God. This is not, yeah, this isn't cool. This is no lightweight stuff going on here. So I come back again, and they're all standing there, and they're all chirping. But I've cruised around again, and I just started taking pucks and just started firing at him. I'm like, bring it on, you fucking.
Giving it right back to him.
So I start feeding wristers right back, hitting the ground, and I'm like, what am I doing? Anyways, Derek's on the bench, and he's laughing. Derek Settlemyer, he's laughing his ass off. I'm like, oh, real funny, Derek. Yeah, real funny. Because he loves that stuff. So anyways, now after warm-up, so I'm sitting there. And so now I'm, you know, got top half of my gear off and sitting there getting my gear on, get gear off, just getting prepped for the first period, knowing that it's going to be a melee. So I'm sitting there trying to get prepped, you know, dreading the inevitable. And Derek comes in, it's like 10 minutes before the game time, 8 minutes or whatever, and comes in, he stands right in front of me. He's like, oh, you wouldn't believe what I just saw. I'm trying to get ready for the game. I'm pretty, you know, I take the game seriously, but he's like, you wouldn't believe what I just saw. I'm like, what, Derek? What? He's like, I was just over on the Binghamton side, and I walked through the weight room, and there's Ray Emery on the bench press. I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, he's got all his top stuff on. He's got his pads on. He's pounding out 235, just pumping it out. And he saw me walk by as he's pumping this 235 out like 20 times. And he looked over. He said, tell Little he's dead.
Doing bench press.
That's my trainer. 5 minutes before a game, telling me that Ray Emery has relayed a message to me. tell Little he's dead. So anyway, the game starts, and I'm like, oh, boy, this is going to get ugly real quick. First shift, there was a fight. Second shift, another fight. Third shift, almost close to a line brawl. If the D jumped from the blue line, it was going to be a line brawl, and I knew that Razor was coming down. But the D never came down, so it was just like a kind of like a two-on-two with a third kind of half scrap. But if the D would have jumped, then Razor would have came, and it would have been a melee. But anyways, they didn't jump, and I ended up playing one of the best games of my entire life because I knew if I could keep it close, then Ray would be down. I think we won 2-1 or something, so he didn't have the chance to get down there, but oh, man, that was quite the show. Yeah.
That's unreal. And I think about the league was just so different back then. And it stuck around through my first couple of years. But what you guys went through, and we'd always joke around calling it the Iron League, what it used to be. Crazy stuff, man. Let's flip back, though. That was a couple years later. Let's flip back, though, to winning that first Calder Cup with Philadelphia. You did it as a starting goalie. You carried the mail. Was that the high watermark of your career at that point?
I think that was probably the most confident that I've ever been. In terms of confidence and knowing that I could do it, was I a better goalie a couple years down the line? Yes, I think I was. But in terms of like knowing that I could do it and I was ready for the next level, I think that was probably the highest I got. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of things came together. We had a good team and I was playing with a lot of confidence. I still remember this being on the ice. I'm like, all right. We played against a pretty good Flames team there, the front team. St. Louis was on Jiggy was on goal. Yes, you get it. Actually, those guys didn't play that great in the final, but they had a good team. St. Louis played good, obviously. I just remember him chirping me every single shift. But yeah, that was probably the most enjoyable run that I've had. Yeah, we won again in 2005, but I was just in a supporting cast with Nitty. Nitty had the ball there, but you know, we had another great team at that time. But as far as pinnacle and feeling like I could do it, yeah, that was probably it.
Year after that's kind of interesting, though, because you didn't stick around Philadelphia. You're in Grand Rapids the following season, and it's the only time that I can see that you weren't in Philadelphia's organization. So how did it come to be that you ended up moving over to the IHL into Grand Rapids?
I had so my contract was up, and I wanted to prove Clarkey that I wanted to be a Flyer. And Clarkey said, well, here's what we can do. You're going to be my number two, but I can't give you like a one-way deal. I mean, you never played, so take this and we'll see how it goes. But you're my number two. I'm like, okay, because the result at that time, it was, I think Beezer was there. But anyways, late August, Clarkey signed Texie to be the number two. So now I'm number three, and number three is not going to work because Brian Boucher was a rookie with me the previous year, and he was a high draft pick, and they had high hopes for him. So, and yeah, another kid coming in, Jean-Marc Pelletier, they didn't have a place for him. So really, I was the odd man out. Once Texie signed, I was pretty much hooped. And, you know, shame on me for not knowing how to negotiate at that time and really maybe shopping myself. But I wanted to prove everybody wrong so badly that I took a 1 year in Philly just to prove that I could do it. Now, it ended up being the worst decision ever. But, you know, right after training camp, I had a great training camp, and that was it. Like I figured, well, see what happens here. Maybe at the very least be in Philly with Bush and, you know, try to do this whole thing again. But it didn't work out that way. They wanted Bush playing the majority of minutes. They wanted Pelletier to be his backup, and I was the odd man out. So I didn't have the heart to ask for a trade because I really didn't know how to do that either. Young, and I had an agent that really didn't know what he was doing either. It was my fault at the end of the day, but go to Grand Rapids. And then that was it. I went from the best team in the league to one of the, you know, we didn't make the playoffs. We're kind of cellar dwellers, and I had to kind of work my way back again. Almost pretty much lost about a year to a year and a quarter, just trying to get my confidence back again. So it took me like till December to even feel like a goalie again the following season. So a full year wasted in Grand Rapids when I thought that was best that I was going to be, and I completely lost it. So, you know, it's mental too. So,
so you were loaned out to Grand Rapids then? You didn't sign with them.
I was under Flyer's contract. Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah, I was under Flyer's contract. Yeah.
Was it just a huge shot across the bow, though, to win the Calder Cup and carry a team and think in your fourth year pro, man, I'm getting some momentum. I just need my chance. And then to kind of get buried again like that? I can't imagine what that had been like for you.
Well, it was tough. It took me a year, about four months almost to really get my mind back where I could actually, you know, try to focus on getting back to where I was. That's how big of a blow it was, because I didn't have the capacity to think in another direction at that time. I'm like, okay, I got this. I'm ready. He said that, yes, I'm going to be the number two. And here we go. I'm going to finally get my shot. And let's go with it. And then, you know, late August, Texie signs, or whenever he signed, it was late. And I'm like, what does this mean? So if you could do it again, you ask for a trade, or you would, you know, I don't know. With this much knowledge, I would definitely do something different. I certainly wouldn't have signed the deal right after based on the assumption that I was going to be number two without a one-way deal. So, yeah, I was naive too. So it's my fault as well. So.
Yeah, but you know, you spent this many years with that organization. I can understand the familiarity of it too. And you think it's eventually you're going to get rewarded. You were a starting goalie in the minors for 6 years, at least minimum. And then you finally get your chance. 2001, 2002, Philly gets you in there. What led up to your first NHL start, and how did the game go?
Well, I'd been up over, you know, 4, 5, 6 year span. I've been up like 10 games here, 5 games there, you know, 5, like probably in grand total. I don't even know what the total was, but if it wasn't a record for 0 minutes, I don't know who's got it. I would have to, if I had to guess, it was probably between 40 and 50 games before I saw one NHL minute. Like nobody got hurt.
Way.
Nobody got pulled. Nobody got nothing.
Well, at least you got paid. That's the good part of it. You got the NHL money for a while.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was just amazing that nobody got pulled in, like, you know, it was more than a half a season of me backing up games and nobody got pulled. But I did finally get a game. Billy Barber was the coach of Philly. We had a back-to-back. We had a game Friday, whatever it was. It was Friday at MSG and Saturday in Carolina, or whatever the days were. It was back-to-back. And Billy was going to play me in MSG. He thought that might be a great way to my first game, but he changed his mind and ended up playing the back-to-back in Carolina the next night. And I played okay, but we got outshot 15-1 in the first period.
Oof.
Or 14-1. It was 1-0. I'm like, what? Obviously, there was a big drop off from the way that we were playing to our first period. And the second and third just kind of went by the wayside. It deflected goals. And, you know, just, I think I let in 4 and 3 of them were reviewed when there was no review.
Oh, man.
You know what I mean? Like, at that time, there was no review, but they were actually reviewing to see how, you know, if it was a high stick or how these pucks, it was just crazy. And Artis Urbay was in. I wanted to fight Artis Urbay. I think I got 10 minutes in penalties and lost 4-1, but that was my first start.
Hold on. How'd you get 10 minutes of penalties? You're glossing
over that. Oh, I think I got
that.
12. I think
happen?
I got 12. 2 for roughing and a 10-minute misconduct. Because it was just, I think it was after one of the, I think it was 3-0. It was after one of the, another just like ridiculously just heartbreaking goal where it went off a couple of things and went in the net. And there was a big kind of scrum around. And I remember hitting someone in the face so hard. It was like a little skilled guy that I couldn't believe that he was still on his feet. And then a big melee. And I remember Urbay coming down to the bench because I had got the penalty, and then a big melee ensued, and he was chirping me from the bench, and I was trying to break out of the pack to go and pound on Artis Urbay, and some big ref at the time, so he's retired now, big mustache, can't remember his name now, he's like, don't embarrass me, and he's got me on a bear hug as I'm trying to get to Artis Urbay. I said, oh, it was Bill McCreary, I think. I think it was McCreary, big mustache.
Yeah, it would have been him.
I said, embarrass you, fuck off. My dad's in the stands. I'm the one that's embarrassed, and I'm trying to get over to Archer Survey to kick his ass. I couldn't get over there. Hell yeah. It was crazy.
Did you at least have the chance to soak it in and say, hey, man, I finally did this. I'm in the NHL. You can't take this away from me. I am here, and I've done it. Did you finally get that feeling, though?
I think afterwards, you know, I just walked with my dad and I said, well, I know it didn't go the way we wanted to, Dad, but, you know, I did my best, and he was happy. You know, my dad was like, I thought it was great. You know, like, you know how dads are. So,
yeah.
So, you know, you get your game in. So
good.
I played another game. Rob Esch got pulled against, I think Carolina won the Stanley Cup that year. So they were pretty good. And I played another game. Rob Esch got hurt on a 5-on-3. I came in on a 5-on-3 against Tampa Bay. Tampa went to the finals that year or won it. I can't. Anyways, the two games I played were Stanley Cup contenders. So that didn't go well.
Well, it's not always going to go perfect every time, right? I've had plenty of those where I'm just going, man, I'm getting another shit sandwich back into the back-to-back. Let's just try to go out here and make it work well.
Yeah. I can't remember who buried one off. One timer off to Tampa. It was a 5-on-3 and, you know, just a tee up for the first goal. And the second goal I got scored against was Ruslan Fedotenko. And he was right in front of the net and just kind of jammed home like a bobbling puck around the crease. And but I remember it because I played with Ruslan, and he just looked at me and said, "I'm so sorry, Litz." He wasn't celebrating; he was apologizing for scoring. So I like that. I like that a lot.
Let's talk about this beautiful equipment you had. You were one of the first guys that I can remember that really started to embrace putting logos on your pads and different colorways and patterns. And Brian's, I think, was your longtime manufacturer who facilitated a lot of this stuff. For this type of things, was it your input or was the company help driving it? How did you come to have these ideas to make them on your pads with the different Phantoms and Flyers logos colors? Was it more your idea
Oh
or?
yeah, that was all me. I was I'm kind of like a artist at heart. So yeah, I used to just I was using Vaughn in college because I loved the look of Vaughn. I loved the look of Andy Moog. Andy Moog was my guy, and he always looked so good in his gear. But I tried to get Vaughn to customize some stuff, but they couldn't do it. They had a, I don't know why they couldn't do it, but and at the time, my first year pro was like Heaton slash Bryant's, so I liked the look of the Heaton pad. Bryant's was maybe not out quite yet, but anyways, I always tried to get them to put my design on the pads, and Bryant's was the first one to say, "Yeah, we can do that." And I don't remember anybody else doing it. Time. So for them to do it was pretty cool, and I just drew out exactly what I wanted, the color scheme. Here's what I want to a finite detail, and they just ran with it. So it was good. I did the same thing with my mask. I'd do the entire design and just give it to a painter. Looking good was a priority, you know.
Do you still get excited when you see a new set of gear that looks really good?
There's a few guys out there with some style, but you know how it is. Like we're gear nerds. I like a guy with a little style, a little suave, a little swagger, humble but swag. You know what I mean? So
Yeah,
I don't mind
exactly.
the pads and stuff like that, but it's got to be done right.
Yeah,
So.
so much of this stuff's just white and bland now. And a lot of the guys, though, like with Bauer doing the digital printing of things, these guys can really thank you and what Brian's was doing years ago because you set the trend on it.
Yeah, Brian's actually wasn't, it was an actual, they used to cut the leather in the pattern that I was showing them. So it was stitched leather. Now it's all digital. So Lundquist pads, it's actual, there's no separate, it's all one piece of leather. But my pads were actually, it was actually cut leather. So they actually have to cut the leather to my specific, and then patch it and sew
Right.
it.
Did you
So.
have anything? Was there anything unique about the specs of your equipment, your pads or gloves or sticks, skates, anything?
Not really. I used to play around with it. I think my length was pretty standard. My width was fairly standard. I remember when I first came to Philly, there was no regulations on pad width. So I remember Richter had a pair of pads in at the ranges that I heard were 15 inches. So I got Brian's to make me 12 at the top and 15 at the bottom,
Oh,
and
and they said no problem, sent them to you.
Yeah, they said, yeah, we can do it. So it was 12 or 11 and a half, 11 and a half at the top and 15 at the bottom. And these things were fantastic.
Yeah, they took up the whole
But
net.
literally you could stand up from any shot from about just past the dot, like 3 feet past the dot, you could stand up comfortably knowing that there's no way that there's You have you the most you'd have to move is about 2 inches to your left. So you took away the short side, closed your legs, and the most you'd have to move is 2 inches to the left. So you really only had, most of the, it was fantastic, but you couldn't walk and you couldn't move, and you kept, like you clipped yourself on the bottom. So moving smoothly and like any kind of butterfly was like it was hard on your knees because I just the angle of your knee to your ankle would be higher than your knee. So there was no way to use your edges to go, but as far as like bad angle shots, home run.
You just stand there.
Literally just stand there. Just stand there. There's no room.
You had a secret weapon in your pocket, I heard, though, with the Phantoms too, though. Can you tell me about Rooney, the shot clock guy?
Oh, Rooney. That was Brian Boucher and myself were Rooney was a shot clock guy in Philly. He was suspect at best because, you know, goalies are shot clock watchers. Like, we based our whole game on getting to, you know, like, if you got one goal on 14, okay, you know exactly what your save percentage is. Now you got two on 50. Now you got to get back. Now you got to stop eight to get back to where, you know, like, we're clock watchers. I'm not sure if you were, but I was.
Oh, absolutely. It would drive me crazy. You'd get buildings where you knew you were going to miss two or three a game. And if that was your home arena, that could be 30 or 40 grand in your pocket by the end of the year, you know, or you might not get a job. So it would drive you up a goddamn wall.
So people don't think about that, but Bush and I were crazed, and Rooney was the shot clock guy, and Rooney was suspect at best because sometimes he'd miss, like, you know, like, it wasn't like two a game. Sometimes he'd miss, like, you know, 6 to 7 to 8. So this went on. It was a running joke. We'd be so mad at this shot clock guy. We was like, this is our home arena. Like, we should be getting, like, at least pay attention. That's all we could do. So finally, there used to be a bar in the Spectrum called Bullies. And the fans would go down there and the players would go down there after we got changed. It was crazy. But the off-ice officials would also be in that bar. And so Brian and I figured out, okay, that's the shot clock guy right there. So we go over there. And it was so funny. I wish, you got to get Bush on here because he's got the best impersonations anyways. But anyways, we come up there and we go, Rooney, you're an asshole. You remember Ferris Bueller? You know,
yeah.
You remember that Ferris? So we used that line, and he didn't know what was going on. It was this Bush and I just berating this guy. He's like, what, guys? And we just tore into him. We're like, you got to do a better job, and blah, 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 blah. But it was so funny because the lead line was, Rooney, you're an asshole.
So he was pretty good from that point forward after buying him a couple beers and giving him the screws.
Yeah, he was better, but I wouldn't say that he was on his A game every night. But you go into Binghamton and you'd have 30 shots, but you'd be credited for 38. So, like, there's some, you know, it goes both ways, but you'd like to think that you'd get credit for your shots that you'd stopped. I don't know. That's the one selfish thing about goalies. Like, we want credit for the things that we've done.
Yeah, well, but that's because that's all we have at the end of the day a lot of times is our stats, especially when there's not always people in the building to justify it. You might get a scouting report, but if the numbers don't add up to it, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. That's why we're so adamant about this stuff.
Well, it usually never works in your favor. So if you miss two shots a game, and you played 50 games that year, it's 100 shots against you. That might get you from 898 to 904. It might get you from 908 to 912. It might get you like to the next level. Like, 100 shots is a lot of shots. Like, it could get you 4 points higher. So, you know, it makes a big difference for us. We're numbers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, was that a big part of those teams back in Philly and in some of the other places you were, though, just having fun like that, having the chance to go to a bar after the game in the building, be with your teammates?
Well, you know as well as that. I play with so many characters, and that was half the fun. So when people say, do you regret anything? Do you wish anything? I would be like, no, I've seen it. I was in Philly for 24 years. I had such a good time that I can't complain. Now, would I have wanted a 10-year NHL career? Sure, I would have, but I cannot complain because I had so much fun and met so many good people that it's hard to say I wish I would have, because I pretty much, you couldn't have done it better. So that's the way I think about it.
That's what everybody who ever played with you tells me, is that nobody could have done it better than you, that you were easily one of the most fun guys I've ever played with on and off the ice. Is there any memories that you have from being off the ice in those moments that were equal to being on the ice, whether just playing with different characters or going to different cities and sometimes the surreal things that can happen you'd never expect? Did any of those stick out to you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stories that were fantastic that I cannot say just because that it would incriminate a lot of people. But that being said, everybody that I don't think I ever had a partner that I didn't enjoy. And I played with so many guys that had different personalities, whether it be shy and reserved to the exact opposite. So I must have played with a couple dozen different guys over my span of in Philly alone. And every single one was a different animal. Like he was a completely different personality than the next guy. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is that I got along and really supported and hoped the best for every single one of my goalie partners, as well as my teammates. I really wanted to see success and happiness in everybody that I played with. And you consider them family. So what do you do for family? You support them, you have fun, and you're on a journey together. And I think that's the way I kind of try to approach it. Now there's a lot of stories in there, but a lot of stories, but I think if I was to be remembered, I wish people would say that I was a good teammate for once. Well, maybe that's the only thing. I was a good teammate and a good friend. So, that's really what I wanted. So.
Well, that's what everybody said here is when I was doing the research, always in a great mood, contagious energy, a lot of fun to be around, really. And they always said you were really light in the locker room too, that you were pretty relaxed. So that's not always a trait that goaltenders have, especially when you have Ray Emery breathing down your neck like you had a couple times in your career. For your last season, though, you ended up playing overseas. Did you know that you're finishing out your North American career and you wanted to at least do one tour of Europe before you retired?
I think so. I think it was getting to that point. I was certainly in a mentorship role. My final year with the Phantoms, Nitamaki had the ball. And, we had a great run. He played fantastic. He was a playoff MVP. I think I got in a couple games in the playoffs. But, it was his ball and his show, and he was fantastic. So once you get to that 34 age, okay, there's not a lot left. I'm a smarter goalie than I've ever been, but maybe not quite as athletic. I certainly wasn't in prime physical condition my entire pro career. I didn't really take care, really fantastic care of myself, but I was always ready to go and I was very competitive and I loved to win. So the two kind of equaled out. Now guys are in fantastic shape. Watch what they eat. Don't drink too much. Make good decisions. I was on the fence with most of those, but so I was 34. I'm like, okay, I want one more year, maybe two. Let's go try the European route. Went to Espoo, Finland. That was a rude awakening as well. Had a good group, but so physically intensive that it was beyond my capacity. Like workouts, we had a coach that took it to an extreme, thought maybe that we were Olympians and the Olympics were like in a week. So like, we were doing uphill sprints over hurdles. We were doing heavy squat days, day before games, like stuff that I was not used to. And I came out of the gates, played great. And they were talking, maybe you should sign here for a couple more years. And, I used to joke that I came out of the gates like Bernie Perrant, and by Christmas time I was that guy who's the dead guy in that movie. That
Weekend at Bernie's. You were Bernie.
Yeah, I was Bernie. I went from Bernie Perrant to Weekend at Bernie's. So yeah, I went from like a 950 to like I got kicked out of the finish league with a 920 save percentage. That's tough to do. So. Yeah, from Bernie to Bernie. Yeah, and then I went to Switzerland. I went to Switzerland for a couple months under Christmas McSorley. I didn't end up playing any games, but I kind of hung out in Geneva for a couple months, and I came back, and that was it. My body was done. My knees were done. Hips were done. couldn't make it to the vehicle at the end of the game. It was just too sore. So.
So you knew it was the right time. That's cool. I had that same feeling this last year that it felt like a farewell tour in a lot of ways. I remember looking at some of the arenas and thinking, this has been an awful lot of fun. It's probably the last time I'm going to see it. So get off the ice and wave goodbye here, just thinking it may not happen again.
Yeah, you had an amazing career. Sorry to cut you off, but I got the chance to watch you a lot, obviously, when you rolled through Springy and I was working for Florida, but I've seen you play Philly, Springy. I've seen you play. You had a hell of a career. And, goalies, we like some guys. We like to watch some guys. We don't particularly care to watch others, but you were a guy that I could watch every night and say, that's a goalie. He knows what he's doing. He's smooth. So congratulations on a great career yourself. So
thanks.
Awesome stuff.
That's a huge, huge compliment, man. I appreciate it. It's funny. I look at the guys that I have so much respect for, and obviously the NHL players and NHL goalies are really high, but I think there's also this kinship amongst the guys who spent the majority of their careers in the minors, like you and I, because we really had to slug it out and know what it took in terms of dedication, and just how well you had to play to keep getting contracts. So that was really one of the biggest reasons I wanted to talk to you too, is because I knew you'd have perspective on what we'd both been through. And I have so much admiration for what you accomplished in your career. I mean, RPI Hall of Famer, Phantoms Hall of Famer, one of the best goalies in the American League for years and years. So I'm so happy you took some time today to join me, because it's been a lot of fun. And like I said, we had a lot of similarities along the way.
Well, it was awesome to talk to you. I mean, we could literally talk for weeks. So it's good talking to a guy that knows what he's talking about and enjoys goalies and enjoys the goalie life and enjoys good stories in hockey in general. So.
We didn't even get to talk about your frosted tips and the goatees that we had in the late 90s.
One of the things that you got to do is you got to go on HockeyDB to pull up some old teammates and see, you just remind yourself of where you've been and what you've done. And that's the first thing I saw was the frosted the frosted tips. I don't know what I was thinking there, but pretty comical. Anyone?
How many guys on your team actually had the frosted tips?
I remember I came with blonde hair. I think I was in Pentick and I had my oldest boy in hockey school at the time. We were in Pentick and I took my dad's trailer out there, and he was busy on the ice all day. And I was like, I think I want to get a little, maybe go blonde. So I went to this salon and got a full blonde do. Yeah, yeah. So I got to camp. The camp was only like 3 weeks later. And I had this blonde hair that was still trying to grow out. And the first person who saw me was Paul Holmgren. He was like, what's going on with your hair? I said, I just spent a little bit too much time in the sun, Homer. Don't worry.
That was common in the late 90s, though, man. Like, so many guys would run that look.
Mine was by default. I was trying to get rid of it, but oh, well. Yeah, I got busted. Yeah. It's funny that somebody took a snapshot of it. Now I can't get rid of that image. Yeah, awesome. Awesome.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.